Welcome to The Roofer Show with your host, Dave Sullivan. You found the podcast that helps roofing contractors grow their businesses, make more money, and have more free time. Each week, Dave interviews the industry's top experts who will give you actionable tips and strategies for the real world of construction to help you take your roofing business to the next level. So let's get down to business.
Hey everybody, what's up? Welcome to The Roofer Show, the place to be if you want to grow a more profitable roofing business. I'm your host, Dave Sullivan, and I've been a successful roofing contractor for over 30 years, and I'm here to share with you what I've learned. Get more tips, strategies, and free downloads by going to my website at theroofershow.com. Today, I've got a great interview with our legal expert, Philip Siegel, and Philip is with Hendricks Philip Salzman and Siegel. Probably heard them on the show a number of times before. We've had some great interviews. We've been working with them for 20 plus years. Well, back before COVID, I saw Philip put on a seminar and he talked about the 10 killer contract clauses. Actually, he was the number one rated speaker out of 21 speakers down there. It was an overflow crowd, good talk, and which is amazing because you sit there for an hour and a half and listen to an attorney talk about how you're going to get screwed working with general contractors primarily and the problems with owners. And he talked about these 10 clauses and how you've got to treat them. You've got to have them in your contract. You've got to deal with them. And that's what's going to keep you out of trouble, out of legal trouble that's going to cost you a fortune and that is going to suck the life out of you if you ever get in one of these disputes. And this is why you've really got to address these. We revised our contract early on to cover most of these issues, and that really saved us a ton of money and a ton of heartache. So this is a great talk. You want to check this out, whether you're doing residential, commercial, working for generals, or just as a prime. These are items, these 10 clauses, these are things that you've got to have covered in your contract. The past couple of weeks, we've been talking about cash flow issues and how cash flow has become a real problem for a lot of contractors. You could be booming, thinking you're making a ton of money, but if you get in one of these disputes and they hold up a lot of cash, you're screwed. You can't pay your payroll, you can't pay your suppliers, and it's a real problem. So everybody's going to want to check out this episode. A few things before we get into the interview. First, Philip and a bunch of other attorneys will be speaking at the NRCA Virtual Legal Conference. Go to this every year, but this is the first one it's going to be virtually. So that'll be interesting. But that's the NRCA Legal Resource Center, and that'll be on October 13th through the 15th. This is a great conference. Everybody should check this out. And that's the NRCA puts this on. And anybody that's not a NRCA member is making a mistake. You got to check this out. They're a great organization and can really help you out. We've been a member for still am for well over 30 years. So it's something that you want to take a look at. Next week, we're going to start another little mini course that we've had, had a couple before, got some great reception on that. And this one is going to be 5 ways to increase your profits on every job. I have Diane Gilson with Info Plus Accounting coming back. You've probably heard her a number of times, and she is my go-to numbers person, how to run your business by the numbers. But check it out, and this is why it's important. Make sure you're subscribed to The Roofer Show, and these will pop up. But you can go to iTunes or go to my website, download them. But it's a great class, and I'm going to do these mini courses, a few more coming up on various topics that I've had requests about. So check it out. It's called Quick Course. Comes out on where I've had my quick tips before, and great, useful information. Take a look at that. And last, I've been working with a number of contractors lately, and I've been getting requests. You guys have really stepped up where I've asked you to just send me a quick text. say hi, talk about what you like about the show, what you don't, give me some feedback, and you can contact me there. Text me at 510-612-1450. And when you're giving out phone numbers like that, can you guys slow down? Have your people slow down, because people are trying to write down the goddamn number. And I can't stand it when people just rattle these things off on a voicemail and you got to go back and play it back three times. But that's beside the point. Anyway, you can text me or go to my contact page, and I've got a little button that you can click, goes to my calendar. And if you want to just schedule a phone call, it's a quick phone call, 45 minutes or an hour. We can talk about business strategy, what you've got going. And I've been doing this a lot, and it's really been great. It's been great for me. I love it. And it's been great for the contractor, getting some great feedback. And what I do is really just kind of go through my one-page business plan, which you can download on my website for free. And it just gives you an overview of your business. Talks about where you're trying to go, you know, your ideal customer, what business you're truly in. We talk about some strategies. And most importantly, what it is try to get you started on setting up processes, which is the only way that you're ever going to get out of this business alive. You're going to be able to build a sustainable business that's profitable, that you can build equity in, that's eventually going to be something that you can sell. And the only way that you can do that is by having a good plan. And you can do that by downloading my one-page business plan off the site, click the button, set up a time with me. We'll talk about it. And what I'm doing now, if it's something that you like, you want to kind of continue and have some areas that you want to work on, I'm doing coaching now, which I've really enjoyed, just kind of starting that. And let me tell you who that's for and what that's about. I've always had a business coach. I still do. And I credit having a coach as one of the biggest reasons why I was successful in my business, why I was able to grow the company profitably. Not about growth, it's about profitable growth. That's what we focused on, and he really helped me succeed. We were a relatively large company, and we could afford to have him fly in and put him up in a hotel for a few days. We did this probably three or four times a year. And it was great, but it was really expensive. And most contractors are not able to do that, particularly the smaller contractors. And these are the guys that really can use the help. So what I'm doing is covering that niche, which really nobody is focused on, which is that startup to really $5-7 million in volume. These are the guys that can really use the help. I don't go out. I don't travel because I'm traveling for pleasure. I want to be able to do this because I'm retired. I can really help companies out, and I can do it from anywhere in the world because we just hop on Zoom. We do a video conference, and we talk about the things each week or every couple of times a month. Can really help you out, get focused, give you some ideas, bounce these things off, and also hold you accountable for making progress in your business. And this service is really not available out there for the smaller contractor, but I can give you one-on-one help if that's something that you want. And it's at a cost that it's affordable because I don't have to go anywhere. It's easy for me to do. I love doing it. So all it does, you start off by clicking that button, jumping on a quick call. If that's something you're interested in, let's talk. And last, I want to thank our sponsor, Ruby Receptionist, who has been supporting this show since the beginning, which is going on almost 2 years. And the reason they do is because a lot of the listeners sign up for their service and they're happy with it. They love it. I get great feedback. If our contractors didn't like their service, they wouldn't be supporting the show. But love these guys. Something you should check out at callruby.com/roofershow. Real quick, let me tell you who they help and how they help you. Ruby is a virtual receptionist, and what they do is they pick up that phone, they answer it professionally in a friendly tone, and they set up that great first impression. And that is teeing up the sale. Makes it easy for you, and you can focus on the things that you should be doing, like getting out there and selling roofs. For the smaller guy that maybe that call is going straight to their cell phone, You're not focused on that call. You're leaving a bad first impression when you're hammering nails and so forth. They can't hear you. You're not focused. So they do a great job for that small contractor. The contractor that's flipping that call over into voicemail or has one of those crappy answering services, they are not going to leave a message. And all that money you spent to get the phone to ring just went in the trash. Or maybe the larger company, they've got a front desk receptionist full time. Well, this is something that is going to save you a ton of money. They're going to do it at a fraction of the price. And they don't take vacations. They don't turn the call in sick. This is a great service. They handle services for all size contractors. So check them out. It's a great service, something I think you'll be interested in. If you like them, we've got a promo going, $50 off the first month's service, 21-day money-back guarantee. So there is no risk to this. Check them out. See if it's right for you. callruby.com/roofershow. Make sure you get the slash roofer show to save you the $50. All right, let's finally get into this great interview with Philip Siegel. Philip, thanks for coming back on the show again.
Hey, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, if you've been a listener to the show for any length of time, you've probably heard Philip speak on a number of topics, and you always get some great ratings, so I know there's always a lot of interest. And we've had a number of episodes. We had episode number 84 with the hidden dangers of using independent contractors and subcontractors. Number 36, the top 5 employment mistakes. Number 114, how to prevent employee poaching by your competitors. And I know that's a huge problem we all face. And the last one, number 32, which we called High Times, drug testing and medical marijuana, which is quite an issue these days. But before we get into it, our topic today, can you give us a little about yourself, what you do, and who you do it for?
Sure, Dave, and I always appreciate the opportunity. So my firm is Hendrick Phillips Salzman and Siegel, and you know, Dave, we've been doing this, and we're far enough along the calendar now where I can say I'm coming up doing this here at my firm for 20 years this fall. And I can tell you our firm is counsel to the National Roofing Contractors Association. So for the last 20 years, I've been representing roofing contractors across the country. In all aspects of construction, my practice happens to have a particular focus in labor and employment law. A lot of those topics that you just went through fall in the labor and employment arena. And then I do a lot of contract review. We have a retainer program for roofing contractor clients where I do a lot of contract review, and that's where I've come up with what we're going to be talking about here today, Dave, the killer contract clauses.
Well, I saw you speak on this. And in fact, from what I understand, this was the number one ranked session down there. Is that right? Out of 21 sessions, you were number one.
Yeah, that's funny. I attended this. There was a call for proposals. I submitted. I was accepted. They gave me an early morning session. I had some concern it wasn't going to be well attended. Well, in fact, it was standing room only. They took evaluations. And a couple weeks later, I happened to get an email from the folks that do such a great job putting that show on every year. And it has an attachment. It's the evaluations, but the gentleman who sent it to me noted in the text, congratulations. And I open up the attachment, and sure enough, they have their speaking seminars ranked, 1 to 21 based on the scores. And, much to my surprise, my session here, Killer Contract Clauses, ranked number one there.
Yeah, that was great. And the room was packed. Yeah, there was standing room only. Why do you think it was so popular, that topic?
Sure. Well, I think two things come to mind. One, it's very practical. I mean, you're signing these contracts, and you a lot of times aren't sure what you're signing or what options you have to get out of what it is that you're signing. And I think people there had an opportunity to hear from a lawyer who brings a whole lot of experience in the roofing industry reviewing these things to hear my take on how to, you know, balance the equities. And then number two, I think contractors, roofing contractors in particular, with the way construction is booming still out there, have some leverage to negotiate better terms in their contracts with general contractors or with owners. And seeing that opportunity, this session presented an instance where they can educate themselves on negotiating those changes again to balance the equities.
Yeah, I'm glad to see it's swung somewhat in our favor these days.
Yeah, about time.
Yeah, really. But the Roofer Show, it's all about real world of roofing and construction. And this is what we always talk about. So I want to make sure that we can talk about these real world situations. You come across these so much in your practice. So as we're blasting through these 10 killer contract clauses, let's try to relate it to some problems that contractors out there have had. It also makes me feel a little better knowing that I'm not the only one that screwed up and made these mistakes, because it's the smart guy who learns from the mistakes of others and not his own. We ready to get into this, Philip?
Sure am, yes.
And you mentioned that we had an opportunity to create leverage. Let's talk about that a bit, because you want to use the AIA Form A401 contract, right? Tell me about that.
Sure. So when you are going to be subcontracting work from a general contractor, one of the more common complaints I hear from roofing contractors across the country when I'm reviewing these contracts is, hey, we're not going to be able to get any of these changes. These contractors tell us it's take it or leave it. Well, you can address that kind of argument on the front end when you're submitting your bid or your proposal. And one thing I suggest is, and you make mention of it, Dave, and that is on your bid or proposal, conditioning your bid or proposal on use of what I say, the AIA A401 subcontract document. That is an equitably drafted, industry accepted subcontract agreement. And if you condition your bid or proposal on that contract document, and then the general contractor wants to send you their contract, you then can say, well, wait a minute, our bid was conditioned on the 401. We're ready to execute that yesterday. On the other hand, if you're going to insist that we execute your contract, we're going to have to negotiate because, and this brings me to my second point of leverage, your price. And the contractor that is looking to get the project going likes your price. You ought to be able to try to negotiate along the lines of, hey, my price is based on the risks that are in the 401. You're asking me through your use of your subcontract, Mr. General Contractor, to take on more risks. Well, I'm going to have to revisit my price. And oh, by the way, that's going to take time. So this may delay your project. And if you're looking to get going, let's do as my bid proposed, and let's execute the 401, and we can negotiate your contract for the next job.
Yeah, we said the same thing. This is probably going back 20 years ago when we started working with your firm. You told us these things. Hey, you need to have these clauses in here. These are going to be problems for you. And I said, no, they'll never do it. But we did get those things in because they are reasonable. And I just want to give a quick plug for your retainer program. You'll take a look at these contracts under the retainer program, which is really inexpensive. Mark it up and you take it back and say, hey, here's some reasonable changes. And generally, we got those things through, and they saved us a lot of money and a lot of heartache. So I just want to give you a quick plug for that because it is a great program. But you start off here with some deal breakers, which I assume if we've got these in here, it's time to walk. What are those deal breakers?
Sure. So this is my short as the attorney. What I will jump in and tell you if you're signing one of these contracts, hey, this in my opinion is a deal breaker. It's a very short list. I don't like to be breaking up deals. I will say as I get into these three items that contractors may have their own deal breakers that go beyond the three that I'm going to talk about here. But number one on the list, really a no-brainer, but I see it, and that's the personal guarantee. Oh, yeah. The owner or whoever it is that's signing the subcontract or the contract with the owner is being asked to personal guarantee the work. That's an automatic deal breaker. Number two, if I see a contract clause, and I've seen it real recently a few times, more frequently than it has been in longer times ago, and that is the prospective waiver of lien rights. That is a document that has you waiving your lien rights before you or your payment bond claim, even before you begin your work on the job. Now, in some states, those types of clauses are void and unenforceable. In other states, they'll enforce the contract as written. And if you're waiving your lien rights before you begin the work, I say that's a deal breaker. And then the last deal breaker, in my opinion, is the broad form indemnity provision, which is the indemnity provision that has you responsible for any claims at its broadest arising out of your work, even if caused by the other side's sole negligence. And again, in some states, contracts that have indemnity provisions that extend to have the indemnitor indemnify the indemnities for their sole negligence, those in some states are void and unenforceable. But in any event, if I see it in the contract and it's a deal breaker. Slowly creeping its way onto that list, Dave, is, and I'm seeing this a lot more in owner-contractor agreements, of course, and that is where the owner seeks to limit its liability to its interest in the property. And when I'm reviewing the contract, I don't know how much equity is in the property. I don't know how encumbered it is by a mortgage. So I'm crossing them out, and I'm noting it when I return the contract that, hey, this is, I'm about to start calling this a deal breaker, but I'm calling it to your attention because you might want to explore this with the owner. I deleted it, but if they insist on keeping it, let's dig a little deeper.
Got it. And I agree with all of those. Well, let's start blowing through these things. Our first one is pay if paid clauses. Let's talk about that.
Well, it is what it is, exactly as it sounds, pay if paid. And that is where in almost every subcontract I am reviewing that comes from a general contractor, it has a pay if paid clause, which is conditioning the roofing contractor's payment on the general contractor getting paid by the owner. And why it's a problem is if the general contractor isn't getting paid by the owner for reasons unrelated to the roof, that roofing contractor is still not getting paid.
Right.
Because those clauses, and unless you're in a state that voids it and says those are unenforceable, the pay if paid clause is interpreted and enforced as written. And you talk about wanting horror stories. I mean, it's the roofing contractor that's not getting paid because there's something wrong with the site utility work. And the owner's withholding payment on a huge pay application that maybe the roofing contractor's only got a small portion of. Maybe 10% of that pay application is for the roofer, but yet they're not getting paid any of it because the owner's not paying any of that pay application. And you get strung out on something like that, and you begin to entertain ideas of offering the general contractor a deal if they'll pay you before they get paid. And, avoiding that situation, it becomes critical. And you hit the nail on the head by saying, hey, in terms of seeking to revise these clauses, Dave, the roofing contractor's got to say, hey, if you're not getting paid because of your work or another trade, that's not an excuse for you to withhold payment from me. It doesn't need to be written up by a lawyer. It's just plain English. If you're not getting paid because of your fault or another sub, I'm still owed payment. And if the general contractor who rejects that, well, again, I hope you've created leverage in the first instance through your price and asking for the 401, because that AIA 401 has no pay if paid clause.
Yeah, that's a huge problem because you have no control over that. You don't know what's going on with the negotiations between the general and the owner. Now, we talked about that last week in our How to Improve Your Cash Flow and Problems with Cash Flow. This is a big one. You're not getting paid. Oh, we're working it out with the owner. Well, you don't have any control over that, and that can drag on for months and months and months and really can leave you holding the bag. That's a biggie. I've seen it a million times. But let's get into number two, and that is indemnification. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, I touched on it when I went on my little rant there a second ago. Indemnification is where the major risk shifting happens in the contract. And we're knocking these clauses out in actually a particular order. I'm asked what the top three are, and we'll get to number three next, but pay if paid and then indemnify, because I know you guys want to get paid. The lawyer, it struggled to put it number two rather than number one, but this is the risk shifting provision where you're being asked to, in the broadest sense, as I explained it a minute ago, assume the liability for the work and maybe damages that you didn't even cause. And while I gave you the really broad form deal breaker a minute ago, the more typical clause has the contract, the roofing contractor responsible for any claims arising out of the work, unless they were, those claims were caused by the sole negligence of the GC or the owner or, you know, whoever the indemnities are. And what we're trying to do when we attack one of these clauses is really we only want to be responsible for one, in the first instance, personal injury and property damage claims. Why do I note those types of claims? Because that's where your listeners have commercial general liability coverage, personal injury and property damage claims. And then number two, I only want your listeners, roofing contractors, responsible to the extent those damages were due to their negligence. Right. I don't want them paying for someone else's negligence. And then to go back to that 401, Dave, the 401 does exactly as I'm telling you. It limits that roofing subcontractor's liability to personal injury, property damages, other than the work itself, to the extent caused by the negligence of the roofer.
Philip, let me jump in here real quick. Just give me a quick definition of indemnification for some of us that may not be clear on what that means exactly.
Sure. So I'll be real practical about it. Consider the case where you are, your listener, roofing subcontractor, is on a commercial project. It happens to be a warehouse, and this, there's inventory inside the warehouse. Well, the subcontractor has executed a contract with the general contractor that has the general contractor getting that says, hey, subcontractor, if there are any claims made against me arising out of this roofing work that you're agreeing to do in our subcontract, you're going, and I have to pay any money out on those claims, you're going to have to reimburse me for those damages. You're going to have to pay me back, and I'm going to make you pay me back, even if I was, in the worst case, Dave, 99% responsible. As long as I wasn't 100% responsible, you're going to have to pay me back for whatever it is I have to pay out. So there may be a claim where the general contractor is actually 99% responsible, but in the subcontractor may be only the 1%, the roofing contractor that 1%. Well, you're paying 100% of the bill if you signed an indemnification provision that has you on the hook for everything arising out of the work, except to the extent, except caused by the sole negligence of the indemnity. So to go back to my example, there's a water gets into the building. There's damage to the inventory. The owner brings a claim against the general contractor, and the general contractor is going to tender that lawsuit to the roofing subcontractor and say, hey, this claim arose out of your work. This is not 100% my fault. This has your hands are in this in some form or fashion, and because of that and the contract you signed, I'm tendering this to you. You have to hire a lawyer to defend me. And oh, by the way, if you settle the claim or it goes to trial and we lose, you're paying the plaintiff. That's what indemnity is.
Yeah, it really sucks. I mean, and I see this a lot in there. And also that duty to defend, that's another really crappy clause that you see snuck in there a lot, don't you?
Yeah, and yes, and you have to look for it. I mean, sometimes that indemnification just says, hey, you have a duty to indemnify and hold harmless. You find that word defend in there. And what I try to do with those is I still am trying to limit our liability to only the fees incurred because the claims caused by our negligence. But really what I find I get some success negotiating is to say, hey, at the end of the day, if you have some portion of responsibility for the claim, you're going to reimburse me for the corresponding percentage of our fees. And why the, you know, that does have the insurance company, your insurance company, your roofing listener coming out the money. But if this claim ends up in a mediation, and a lot of these do, but court ordered in most instances, that's still leverage at the mediation to effectuate a settlement at that time. So there is practical, I mean, that there's real practical value. Not many cases get to trial, but to be able to hold that in your hand in a mediation has significant value.
Right.
I speak
right.
from experience.
Yeah, I hear you. Okay, number three, this is something that we see all the time, is additional insured. What's up with that?
Well, you know, we just went through the indemnification, and let's say you're successful limiting your liability to your only those damages due to your negligence. Well, you got to make sure what you're getting through the indemnity is not being taken away through the additional insured requirement in your contract. And again, your roofing contractor listeners, almost every contract is requiring them to name the entity they're contracting with in a minimum as an additional insured on their insurance policy. And allowing that entity to claim on your insurance policy if a claim is made that is covered by the policy. And what we try to do, similar to what we do with the indemnification provision, is to say, hey, that the duty to defend is intended to only cover those claims that are brought against you because of our negligence. And again, I mentioned the 401, and why I try to get us there in the first instance is because that's exactly what the 401 provides. There is additional insured requirement there, but in, even in the owner contractor agreement under the AIA documents, which, and Dave, this is important, that's the A-104 if you're contracting with the owner. The A-104 in 2017 is the short form agreement your roofing contractor should be executing with owners if the owners say, hey, give me a contract, and your listeners don't have one. But what we're trying to do is limit the coverage to only claims due to our negligence.
Okay, so number four, waivers and releases.
Yeah, so waivers and releases, the deal with waivers and releases, what concerns me is language that has us releasing claims as of a certain date as opposed to the extent of payment received. And often you will be finding in contract language that has you go through the contract and it says that, hey, in exchange for the progress payment, you're going to be releasing all claims as of that date. Or in exchange for final payment, you're going to be releasing all claims. And in each instance, particularly, let me address final payment first. With regard to final payment, if it's truly final payment, then I just want to make sure that the release is limited to claims for payment. And so I'm adding the words for payment, and that's because I don't know if there's going to be any kind of workmanship claim down the road or worse yet, personal injury or something, and I don't want to have the general contractor or the owner argue, well, you can't come after me because you accepted final payment. Mm-hmm. And the progress payment scenario, Dave, it's where you do have claims that are pending and you are not addressing in the contract this clause that has you waiving those claims by accepting payment. And you need to be adding language in the contract. And in, if you don't get it in the contract, you want to make sure you get it in. If you're asked to sign any actual waiver forms in exchange for payment, something accepting out those claims that you have presumably identified in writing that remain unresolved or change orders that have not yet been processed. But really, it's about reading these clauses carefully in the contract. They're in the payment provisions. And also where you need to look, and this is terribly important, your clients, your roofing contractor listeners, Dave, they're getting these contracts. They come with the exhibits. And the exhibits are the change order form, the lien waiver form. The time to address those forms and making revisions is in the negotiation. At the time you sign the agreement, and then you get to your first or second progress payment and you want to be reserving claims, you know, the other side's got a real good argument that, hey, wait a minute, you signed my contract, you already accepted these forms. And that's a tough, you're going to spend a lot of attorney's fees arguing that case.
Yeah. I've got a lot of contractors that I work with. They've got large contracts. I tend to just kind of go through them and touch base on some of these things. And they've already signed these things, and rather than having them really reviewed beforehand, because once you sign them and you're into the project, it's too late. I got to imagine you run into this a lot.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's, I could joke and say that keeps me busy. But it wouldn't be a real joke. I mean, it does. That is often the case. And, you know, those, I don't want to make too much light of it, but those become our best retainer clients because you learn there is value. And you also learn to kind of go back to where we started. Those contractors that say we don't accept any changes, it's never true.
Right.
And even if you're just, well, we may turn one of these contracts back to you with a dozens of changes. If you get three or four, you know, those three or four can make all the difference in terms of your bottom line.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And that's what we did, like negotiating anything. And maybe you would send them back, as you say, with five of them. And if we could get two or three, we considered it a score. So I think that's great. Okay, number five, we've got scheduling. Now, this is always a problem, or can be, when you're working with general contractors, which is just one more reason why I never worked for general contractors. But what do you have with scheduling?
Sure. So, you know, every contract, of course, has a schedule. And what I suggest in all cases, and this is another important point for your listeners, is to make sure you're inserting a provision in the contract that allows you an agreed upon minimum number of work days with conditions suitable for roofing work. Mm-hmm. I mean, writing it out just as I articulated it, just writing in there, hey, we need X amount of work days with conditions suitable for working roofing work within which to achieve substantial completion. And you get that in the contract, and then you get to the end of the job or toward the end, and there's allegations of delay. You can go back and count how many days did we have available for roofing work when you consider the availability of the site and weather. How many days did we have with conditions suitable for roofing work in our contract, and did we, in fact, get all those days while the general contractor's yelling us that we're the cause of delay? And what you'll find in the best cases, of course, is that you do the count, and we haven't yet hit the number in our contract. And that it's just a critical clause because, of course, being toward the end of the project here, we have to worry about, you know, delay claims and whatnot, and it becomes frustrating when you're bound to a schedule that is ever changing and you're not even consulted on schedule changes. And you don't have to worry about any of that if you get in the agreement, hey, no matter what, we're going to be entitled to, and again, you fill in the blank, X number of days with conditions suitable for roofing work within which to achieve substantial completion.
I agree, because general contractors, there's always some reason why the roof's not quite ready, or we've got to have this. Why don't you just pull off for a couple of days? You get to the end of the project and boom, liquidated damages. So that sucks. But number six, and I've never seen this before, number six is back charges.
Yeah. It seems I'm dealing with issues, and what I'm trying to address in these back charges are, you're at the end of the project and you're being assessed back charges that relate to months earlier and you had no notice of. And every contract that we're seeing that roofing contractors are executed includes a provision that says, hey, if you don't perform and we have to spend money, we're going to hold it against your agreement or what you're owed under this agreement, and maybe others if it's far reaching. And what we want to make sure to add is a provision that says, hey, we need to have notice if you're going to be assessing us the back charge, and you want to have, you know, I don't know, 7 days from when the back charge is allegedly incurred. The idea here is we want to be able to respond and investigate and maybe take care of it ourselves without having to deal with an inflated back charge down the end of the road. So, you know, what is reasonable? Asking for you get at least within five days of the act or omission that is the basis for the back charge. You know, in other words, if you're being back charged and the general contractor is pointing to something you did, they need to give your roofing contractor listener at least 5 days within 5 days of that event. Hey, here's the back charge. And that allows us to gather evidence that's fresh to respond and fight that back charge. The other thing about back charges, and I kind of hinted at it a second ago about defective work and whatnot, this idea that setting off between agreements is something you ought to be, your listeners ought to be looking for. That is, roofing contractors signing a contract with the general contractor, and the provision says, hey, if you default and I back charge you here, I can hold money from you on this agreement and any other agreement that we have, or you may have with any of my affiliate entities in its broadest sense. And we're always looking to delete that. We want to keep each contract separate, but your listeners need to be on the lookout for that. Because if you agree to it, it's enforceable as written. and it's going to mess up, you know, your ability to pay sudden suppliers on other jobs where there are no issues.
Exactly. As I mentioned before, these kind of things can just kill your cash flow because these can drag on and on and on. And this is why it's so important to make sure that you've got these things covered. Now, number seven, well, here we go again. Change order issues.
Yeah, you talk about things dragging on and on. It's be on the lookout for change order clauses and contracts that don't provide any means for you to get paid, you know, immediately or with the next progress payment, that leave it for, you know, the end of the project. You got to worry about that kind of thing. Or the contract doesn't include any language about any specific language as to how you're going to be compensated. It leaves it very vague or open to a future agreement without any, you know, what I would say, just protection that no matter what, we're going to get reimbursed our costs plus, you know, X percent for overhead and profit. You know, you might need to have your listeners insert that provision into the contract so we know, you know, hey, if we can't agree, I'm at least getting this, and I could submit for it on my next pay application. It's about looking really for limited markups or no language at all that provides for how you're going to get paid. And then I worry about language in change order provisions that say, and, you know, Dave, I know you're going to get a kick out of this one. You proceed without a written change order, and that's on you, and we're not paying for it. When you're being told in the field, get going on this, you're holding up the project. You know, how do you deal with that? So you either delete it, or Dave, and this is one of those important nuggets here, you add to the contract the simple sentence that says, general contractor shall not orally order changes to the work. General contractor shall not orally order changes to the work.
Yeah.
Or something that says as simple as, hey, a subcontractor shall not be obligated to proceed with change order work until and unless it has a written change order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and these are killers. I mean, this is, you see this so often. And also, what you mentioned before is you've got to have it in there. You want to get paid for that change order in your next draw. Contractors tend to want to wait until the end of the job. And whether it's with a general or whether it's with an owner, whether you've got it in writing or not, if you wait till the end of the job, chances are you're not going to get it. That's why it's so important to get paid as you go. All of these things are just cash flow killers. Okay, well, we've got number eight, which is building code and design.
Yeah. So this is one that really I think my partner Stephen Phillips would argue should go higher up on the list. It's these contract clauses that roofing contractors don't know it because they seem somewhat innocent, but are looking to hold the roofer responsible for design. And which provisions are those? It's really the compliance with laws provision, or the provision that says, hey, you're going to perform your work in accordance with the contract documents and applicable rules and regulations and building codes. And it's not on the roofing contractor, who is not a design professional in almost all instances, in my experience. They are not engineering or not providing architectural or engineering services. Our clients aren't. They're being saddled with this responsibility. Well, you know, we have to make clear that, hey, our roofing contractor obligation to comply with rules, regulations, building codes is conditioned on the contract documents being in compliance with those areas of the law, because we're going to follow the contract documents. We're going to agree to perform the work on in a good and workmanlike manner in accordance with the contract documents. And if the plans and specs are not in accordance, that shouldn't be on us, unless we know it. If we know something is in violation of code, then we ought to have an obligation to speak up, and I'm okay accepting that. But otherwise, where we see a provision that says, hey, you're going to be performing in accordance with applicable laws, regulations, building codes, I'm just adding there at the very end of the sentence, and this is an important point, comma, provided the contract documents are in compliance therewith. Provided the contract documents are in compliance therewith. And I'm just signaling to the other side, hey, we are not design professionals, and if we get into a conversation about it, I'm noting just that. And I'm also saying, hey, wait a minute. you want to hold us responsible for design? Well, we need to get a design consultant, and that's really going to mess with our price and our schedule because we are not a design firm.
Now, what happens? We've got so many contractors out here that are writing their own specifications. We get a re-roofing situation directly with the owner. Are we taking on that design liability when we come in, we're going to tear off the roof and we're going to install GAF, whatever the specification is? Are we taking on that liability?
Not if you are using our contracts, you're not, because our contracts in those instances where you're contracting directly with an owner and provide that, just as I have been speaking, it's in plain English. We're not an architectural or design firm. It's up to the owner to retain. I'm telling you, this is a provision in a contract that is, and I should tell you, Dave, this is outside of the retainer program. Mm-hmm. But when we're preparing contract documents for commercial roofing contractors that are being provided to the owner, it does include a provision that says the owner is responsible for retaining a building consultant to review and make sure, and an engineer, that the plan, we're code compliant. And by the way, the roof is structurally sound to withstand the scope of work that is about to take place. We're addressing that in the contract. We are not accepting that responsibility, and we ought to be very clear when your listeners ought to be very clear when they're doing that work upstream that, hey, you know, we're going to do the work that's outlined in the contract, but we are not providing any warranty that it's in compliance with rules, regulations, code.
Well, it sounds like rather than going down to the stationery store and picking up one of those blank contracts, we're best off to give you a call and have a professionally written contract that we're going to use for the next 20 years. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. One plug for my partner here, Stephen, who I'm sure many of your listeners know. He's got 35 plus years of experience handling claims around the country, strictly roofing contractor issues. So it's a piece of work that has incredible value.
Yeah, I agree. You guys did ours, kept us out of a lot of trouble, and we would always want to use that contract, not somebody else's, but have this in there because it did have all those clauses that really kept us out of a lot of trouble over the years. All right, well, let's get into number 9, and that is damages to work.
Yeah, so this, your typical contract clause, and I'm sure many of your listeners will hear it and know it's familiar, and that is you're responsible for protecting the work until it's accepted by the owner. Doesn't matter that your listeners aren't on site or the roofing contractors moved on, but the language in the contract has you responsible for any damage to the work, however caused, until the owner's accepted it. And, you know, those, again, are enforceable as written if you agree to it. So, you know, what do we do with those clauses? Well, a couple things. We want to, one, obligate the general contractor either to procure builder's risk coverage for the project or for the general contractor to require the owner to get it. That's number one. And number two, we also want to add a provision that I'm going to tell you here in a second. It sounds like it's fair. It's unbelievable how much pushback we get on it. And that provision just says, hey, if our work is damaged by another trade, one of your other subcontractors, you're going to backcharge that sub and pay us to repair. What's objectionable about that? It's a tough question for me to answer. You'll have to ask your general contractor customers, but that's what we try to do with those. Builder's risk coverage, get it in place. And by the way, if it's in place, I will caution your listeners, be wary about language that has you responsible for the deductible. Because I've seen some of these deductibles are in excess of $100,000. So where you are reading your contract and it has builder's risk, that's great. Where it mentions that you're on the hook for the deductible, just add a sentence that says, the deductible shall not exceed $5,000, period.
Okay. I like that. All right, Philip, our 10th and final killer clause, acceptance of adjacent or contiguous, that's a big word, work or work of other trades. What do we got going there?
Sure. Well, this is one that's terribly important. It's number 10 on the list, but again, it's really hard to, once you get past those top three, it's hard to figure out the rest of the order. But if you've had roofing, if your listeners have had the experience where a deck issue has caused the roof system to fail, and they've signed a contract where they've accepted the condition of the deck by proceeding with the work, that they understand the value of this addressing these clauses. And again, the typical clause says, hey, you commence work, you're deemed to have accepted all of the work that preceded yours, including what's a subsurface. And ultimately, again, these clauses are enforceable as written. And what I caution contractors to be wary of is, one, the clause, and two, how to go about revising it. And what you ought to do is, in the first instance, if you're signing a contract that has an imposes on your contractor listeners the obligation to report discrepancies or defective work of others, let's make sure that notice obligation is conditioned upon us actually discovering the defect, knowing about it. You know, you sign a contract that just says you have to notify us of any conditions that would adversely affect your work. That covers known or unknown. That's why you need to add the language that says, hey, we're going to let you know about conditions that we discover or know about. And then in terms of contract language that would have you do a full investigation of the site, and your price is all based on this full investigation, we want to make sure that we're only accepting what is visible, that, you know, our price is based on the visible conditions at the site. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, we want to address that risk about, hey, continuing with the work over the work of another trade. I don't want to be on the hook for what I can't see. So what really are we accepting as the roofing contractor when we proceed with the work? Well, we're only saying that the surface to which we're going to put our materials appears satisfactory for us to proceed. The surface is what we're saying is okay, and that's why we proceeded. But we're not going to be responsible for other trades' work or design. And it doesn't, you know, that's all you're adding to the contract. You know, that our prosecution of the work indicates only that the surface to which our materials are going to attach appears satisfactory for us to do the work. And then adding a sentence that just says subcontractor is not responsible for other trades' work, or subcontractor is not responsible for design. You know, just listen to what I just said. Who's going to object to that? On the other hand, if the general contractor says, no, I do have you responsible for the other trades' work or the other or design, well, you know, how are your listeners going to react to that?
Yeah, well, if you've been in this business for any length of time, you've probably got stung by one of these clauses, some of the problems. I mean, I saw them all the time. Philip, give us a little more information on your retainer program, because it's a great program, kept us out of a lot of trouble, avoided a lot of these problems up front rather than getting in to it afterward.
Sure. So, the biggest value here, we're just talking about the killer contract clauses. This is the biggest value of the retainer program. It's a loss leader for us. I want to say that up front, because a lot of roofing contractors think, I don't want to have my contract reviews. It's going to take the attorney hours to get through this thing. It's going to eat away at my profit on the job. So we'll just, you know, sign it, move on, and cross our fingers. Well, that's exactly the situation we want to avoid. Your loyal listeners that have heard me before have heard me talk about our whole practice, our whole culture is about getting in on the front end, avoiding litigation. Our clients don't have litigation budgets. They're not the litigious type. They're very practical. They've got money to earn, families to feed, and employees to make sure are going home safe at night. And part of that is making sure we're signing a good contract. Now, we don't want you to think the clock's running, and that's why you're not going to send us the contract to review. So when you consider what our standard hourly rates are and what we charge per month on the retainer, that's why I say it's a loss leader. The contractor's way ahead of the game if you factor in the value of the time based on our hourly rate and what we're actually billing. Every retainer client really pays a different amount based on how much they're using it. But I don't just say this because it's my firm. I know that can sound shallow, but it's the deal of the century. We are providing you with revisions to the contract. It comes with a cover email where we're identifying what's most important, explaining in simple terms what we're intending, so you can take that and make your case to the general contractor. But it's not just the contract reviews that fall under the retainer, Dave. It's also, again, I don't want you not calling a lawyer because you're worried about the clock. So anything that we can generally resolve within an hour that doesn't require any research is also within the retainer. A lot of issues I'm dealing with, a termination seems to be, you have an employer with a medical condition or you're looking to terminate someone, that's almost all cases a call I'm handling under the retainer with a retainer client.
Yeah, it's a great program. I recommend everybody check that out. It is incredibly inexpensive and cost-effective. So get in touch with Philip on that, and you can get into the details. I've got a couple of minutes. I just want to hit on some of these past shows for those listeners that haven't caught these, because these were great shows, really had some great information. And I just want to touch on number 84, and that's the hidden dangers of using independent contractors and subcontractors. And I am seeing so much of these where they've either got salesmen, they've got roofers in the field, and these guys are not independent contractors the way that I see them using them. And so I'm always telling them to give Philip a call and check that out. But this is something that you really want to be aware of, because it has stung a lot of contractors. It's cost them a lot of money. Episode number 84. Philip, wouldn't you agree that's a big issue we see in this industry?
It's still a big issue, and it's a bigger issue today than it was back when we did episode 84. Not so much in the context of the state auditors coming in, but employment-related claims. You know, contractors are hiring more independent contractors. They're not able to find the employees, and there's a number of reasons this is done. But then you get one disgruntled independent contractor makes a claim for overtime pay, and then you get then at that point you get either a plaintiff's attorney or the Department of Labor in on your payroll records. Also, it comes up unemployment claims I'm seeing from independent contractors that want to claim now that they were employees. And then, you know, in OSHA, I do a lot of OSHA defense work, and that's an area of the law that certainly hasn't slowed down. And I will tell you that when you're putting these people, classifying these people as independent contractors and hoping to avoid an OSHA citation by saying they're not our employee, that's just not, you know, OSHA looks and frowns upon that, and you're going to have a problem either way as the exposing employer. They're going to come at you real hard as the controlling employer, because they don't like how you're classifying workers essential to the company. In other words, your roofing company, you ain't going to be able to do the roofing work without these guys, and you're 1099-ing them instead of calling them your employees. You know, the OSHA has a hard time with that. And oh, by the way, in a lot of these cases, we can joke about it, but these 1099s, they get asked, well, who's your employer? And they say, you know, the roofing contractor.
And once you get these guys into your business, you are screwed. They're going to find a lot of problems. You do not want to have that. And it is always that one disgruntled employee, happens all the time. So episode number 84, check that out. But I also, we were talking earlier before we started recording on episode number 114. We did this not too long ago, and this is how to prevent employee poaching by your competitors. And we were talking about that, and you had mentioned that you're really seeing a lot of that going on here. And in addition to listening to this episode 114, what's going on here recently?
Sure. So this is you know, what I commented to you, Dave, before we got on the show, is that this is where I've seen the biggest uptick in terms of my labor and employment practice. OSHA's remained pretty consistent. I'm very busy around the country with OSHA defense work. I've always been. But this uptick in how many times I'm being asked to review or prepare these non-compete, non-solicitation agreements. I mean, not a week goes by that I'm not seeing one. I have already seen one. Here we're doing this on a Tuesday. I just reviewed one yesterday out of Texas. And it's that companies are either, we're far along now into what has been a good, robust economy, particularly with regard to construction, that maybe a year or so ago, some companies started to implement these in their workforce, seeing that there may be opportunities for their employees elsewhere, or that they would be subject to poaching because it's hard to find good people, but there's a lot of work. So there's were a lot more of these agreements put in place a year ago, and now here we are. These employees are looking to jump ship, or my clients are looking to hire these people, and I'm being asked to comment on the agreement on whether it's enforceable or not. And then, you know, really, it frustrates me because we do. If you're a client or if you're not, I welcome you to join our email blast. Just shoot me an email, and I'll get you on it. But I talk every year about getting these agreements in place for those employees that you feel ought to have them. And what's frustrating to me is the call I get, and it comes in pretty frequently. I have the employee that's left. He's calling on my customers. What can I do about it? And then I ask the question, and I'm bracing for the response because I know more often than not it's going to be, no, I don't have that agreement in place.
Yep.
So companies are closing the barn door after the horse gets out, proverbially, as it is. But there's no doubt in this labor market that that is where, and if you're looking at a graph, that work has spiked.
Every day there are your competitors that are out at your jobs talking with your guys, offering them more money, constantly trying to get these guys to come work for them. And the biggest thing that you can do to prevent this, in addition to having good paperwork, as we're talking about, is always be recruiting, always be training, and always be retaining. Guys do not leave generally for more money. They leave because they're not being treated fairly. They're not being treated with respect, not appreciated. All types of those reasons. We talk about this on a number of episodes on the show, but everybody's talking about, hey, I just can't get anybody good and so forth. Well, you can. They're out there. But the first thing is you want to make sure that you retain the guys that you have. Check out that episode. That is a good one. And Philip, I want to thank you so much for coming on and giving, as always, great information to our listeners. How can they get in touch with you when they tell them that they heard us on the Roofer Show?
Our website is hpssslaw.com. That's H as in Hendrick, P as in Phillips, S as in Siegel, and LAW.com. And my email address, Dave, PJS, my initials, PJS at hpssslaw.com.
Philip, I appreciate it as always. Thanks for coming on, and we will talk to you soon.
All right, Dave, thanks for having me, and thanks everybody for tuning in.
All right, well, that's it for our show today. I really appreciate everybody listening. If it's something that you're interested in, you want to talk to me one-on-one, just go to my contact page, click the button, goes to my calendar, you can set a time, and we can talk. It's a free call, see what's up in the business, and see if I can help you, do a strategy call for 45 minutes or an hour, and see what's going on. All right, well, we will see you next week on The Roofer Show.